There is something about, we're not meant to chastise, we're not whipping ourselves being who we are. There is a sense of acceptance, deep acceptance and love for who we are, which I think is the first step towards everything. And, you know, there are things that I want to change for the better.
Would I like to stand on the bimmer, like comfortable for 25 hours? You know, it's a really long day. Would I like to be more comfortable? Yes. Do I like the idea of wearing white and shrouds and kittles? Yes. Will I allow myself to do that? No. Even though the rest of my clergy team is in white, I can't. I just can't do it. I can't look like I'm in my nighty.
Rabbiting on. Rabbiting on.
Welcome back to Rabbiting On. We're recording this right in the middle of the High Holy Days between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. So whether you're listening to this before or after Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, we thought we'd focus particularly on the practice of fasting, which of course many of us observe from sundown on Kol Nidre, the eve of Yom Kippur, until sundown on the day itself, when many of us will refrain from eating or drinking anything at all, not even water. And perhaps we'll talk about, you know, the challenges of being a rabbi or cantor of leading when you're fasting, if we're fasting. And we know there are other fast days during the year as well. The other major one is Tisha B'Av. And we did an episode about that, didn't we, a while back as well. So you can have a listen to that if you've missed it. But today we're going to really focus on the commandment to afflict yourself on the 10th day of the Hebrew month of Tishri, which we're about to hold and mark tomorrow, which each year is Yom Kippur. So first of all, before we go into afflicting ourselves and talking about what that means for us, I'm sure we're all feeling that sense of affliction anyway, because this is an intense time to be a rabbi, isn't it? So how's everyone doing? How are you doing, Miriam?
I feel like I'm on that treadmill, and as long as my legs just keep going, we'll be okay. And it would be really easy to slow down and slip off the back, but I'm powering on. But it's always at this time of year also that I realise, is Sukkot this close to Yom Kippur every year? Because actually that's the problem. It's not even the Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur. It's the, how did Sukkot get to be so close to Yom Kippur as well?
And then there's a Shabbat in the middle of them this year with a bar mitzvah in my case. And I was standing on the bimah last Shabbat going, hang on, there's one day to get that sermon written, and oh my goodness, no, I'm gonna have to do that before Kippur, I think.
I got a wedding on Sunday too. It's like life cycle fantastic.
And of course Simchat Torah is also just literally on the back of that as well,
and the emails just keep coming.
Stop
sending me emails, please. Just till next week.
This is a national broadcast to anyone who might be emailing Rabbis Miriam, Robin or Debbie. Please do not be in touch with us. No. But it is an intense time. I found myself, I went to some, and I haven't been able to do this for 2 years, but I went to a coffee shop yesterday, my day off, but it has to happen because time's precious at the moment, to finish off some sermons. And I haven't been in a coffee shop to do that because of the pandemic. It was great. And just found myself weeping, writing a sermon, partly because I was remembering our colleague and teacher, Rabbi Sheila Shulman, who I was really close to, and I was writing a little bit about her teachings of me. But I think just there's something about the immensity of this time, the intensity, the anxiety of being at this moment in the pandemic as well, that I was just really feeling. And it was quite cathartic, actually. I'm feeling better for it, but also a little bit kind of fragile, I guess.
That sounds really powerful. If it's making you cry as you're writing,
if it makes it. Yeah, maybe. I don't know whether that's a good test or not. If I cry, we'll see.
But I think there's also something about that first time that we do something after the pandemic that brings something out in us and allows us to feel all that loss, right? All that, those 19, 18 months when you weren't sitting in coffee shops and when you weren't doing the things that were just so normal. We talked a little bit last time about the 10 Q questions. I think, did we talk about that last time? Do you 10 Q? So there's this online resource, Do You 10Q, which is 10 questions that you get sent in the 10 days to answer about what your last year has been like, what your goals are for the next year. And before Rosh Hashanah, you get sent your answers from the last year. And kind of reading my reflections from this time last year of, you know, all the things we were missing out on and the uncertainty about if we would ever go back to what was normal. It was quite moving. And I think it's totally understandable that you're sitting in a cafe crying.
There's something about holding the responsibility this year, though. Like last year, we were holding the idea that actually we needed to be apart, we needed to be online, we needed to be creative, but at least we knew everybody would be safe. And this year, I feel a huge weight of responsibility. You know, for Rosh Hashanah was just beautiful and incredible to have more than 1,000 people all together. And we'd done that outside in a stadium so that we could make sure that we were outside and doing that as well as possible. But you know, I still hold on to this great, great sense of responsibility of, am I doing enough to keep everybody safe? And it would be so easy to default into, I don't want to have this responsibility, let's just keep everything on Zoom. But I know that actually we have to keep moving things forward, and people so want to be together and want to be as part of that community. And so, it, you know, holding that intention, I think, is weighing really heavily and also taking its kind of emotional and physical toll.
Yeah, I really found that a Rosh Hashanah, likewise, we had a really special, powerful Rosh Hashanah gathering, and seeing everyone was just beautiful, and lots of people reaching out for hugs, and I wasn't hugging because I think, and what I said to one person, I heard myself saying, I want to make it to Yom Kippur. And I thought, I didn't mean it in such a kind of existential way, but there was part of me that thought, I actually mean that. I don't want to catch COVID. That is in the air. And it's making me reflect. We're talking about Yom Kippur and this sense of afflicting and the embodied practice of fasting. We can talk about different ways of that. But there's a sense that this year, the affliction and last year, is already there. Like, I don't feel like I need to step into a space of restriction and affliction, because like everyone, we've been living it for a good nearly 2 years now of what that means. And I think I'm going in with an intention of being much more gentle, much more compassionate with myself and in terms of what I'm saying to the community, to try and say, yes, we're going to have severe liturgy. We're going to have, you know, the judgmental God that we see, particularly at Yom Kippur, but to hold alongside that the compassion. We like chant, don't we, Ashamnu, we have abused, we have betrayed, and we beat our chest traditionally. And one, I can't remember who taught me this, taught a teaching of, instead of beating your chest, you can hold your chest as you do it, like you kind of stroke your heart as doing it. And that for me is my symbol of going into Yom Kippur, of actually holding ourselves within the affliction, because it feels so real for us.
I think for me, one of the strange things that happened on Rosh Hashanah in terms of us all coming back together, for some people who are real stalwarts of the community, who I've seen on Zoom over and over again, but of course I started my role in the middle of lockdown, and this was their first time returning to shul, which was very emotional for them. And you know, there were people who were sort of in tears over that, I think. But for me, there are people who I've only seen from the chest up, and they were not the height I was expecting in so many cases. And you just realize, you build an image of someone over Zoom, and then in person it's completely different. But you know, so wonderful to stand on a bimah with people in front of you, having stood on the bimah with no one in front of us last year, even though the majority actually were still coming online.
Yeah.
Having the response of a congregation and the feedback loop was so important.
Yeah, I have heard many conversations, people commenting on height, but also weight, which is completely inappropriate, of, oh, you've lost weight over lockdown, or you've put on weight, which is interesting, because I think that Yom Kippur for me, we have this idea of fasting on Yom Kippur, which for a lot of people, it seems, is an elevated mitzvah throughout the year. Like, you might not do much practice, but you fast on Yom Kippur. Like, if you don't do anything, you fast. And for me, I find fasting incredibly difficult because of, you know, I don't know, being a young woman in this world and what it is to eat and disordered eating and all of that stuff. Fasting is super difficult for me. And actually, fasting brings me more into my body, more aware of it, and more stressed, actually. It does the opposite of what I think fasting is meant to do, which is meant to enhance and to help concentrate on the soul and the words and the rhythm of the festival. How do you find fasting? What does it mean for you to fast, Miriam?
So for me, there's something interesting, particularly after being at home, working from home for the last 18 months as well, and being within, you know, inches of the kitchen always. And actually, one of the things I realize is I very, very rarely allow myself to feel hungry. And that might sound like a strange comment, but if you pick and if you nibble and if you live your life in a way that says, well, I don't really need a big breakfast, but I'll just have a, or actually there's something of a reminder within fasting that is to experience bodily feelings, physical feelings that you don't allow yourself to feel in the rest of the year. And so for me, there's something less about that thing that's kind of connected to weight or physical, you know, looks, and much more to do with what it means to live in such a fortunate place, to be so not having to notice what's in the fridge, what's in the cupboard, worry about being able to pay for that week's shopping, worrying about feeding my child rather than myself. None of those things, you know, fortunately, are part of my reality. And within the fast, there's a moment of acknowledgement of that, that I allow myself to go without in a way that actually I never do.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting conversation. We held a session in the middle of Yom Kippur last year on disordered eating, essentially, and looking at what fasting does to us, but also what it triggers in us. And a number of years ago, I was approached by a then medical student who at the time wanted to remain anonymous, but has since been very happy to share that it's now Rabbi Deborah Blaustein. But when she was a medical student, came to speak to me about needing a ritual for Yom Kippur that gave her permission to eat, because fasting actually tied in to disordered eating and reinforced something that was essentially the absolute opposite of teshuva for her. And together we created this ritual that's available online. It's on Ritual Well, it's in various other places, which essentially offers a plate of food that is intentional, with blessings for each item and sustenance from them. And I think I agree with everything Miriam said about how I love the process of fasting and the mindfulness of it. But I'm also very mindful that it can be hugely triggering. And for some, it's not teshuvah. And we have to be really clear that it's Yom Kippur is about a lot more than fasting. There are other things we can do to perform teshuvah beyond fasting. And fasting is just one of those things. There is, you know, all sorts of these other pieces of prayer, of tzedakah, of not washing, of not putting on perfume, not wearing leather, all say something very clear and different about this day. Wearing white or wearing a kittel, which is a shroud that we're buried in, that goes back to this idea that this is a period of almost sadness, where we as close to what it means to think about death as we would ever be. But actually, that's an Ashkenazi mindset around this. And in the Sephardi world, they don't wear the shroud. And it's a much more joyful occasion of, this is our second chance. We've got a clean slate. And the Talmud actually links Yom Kippur to being like Purim. Yom HaKippurim is Kippurim, like Purim, which is a day of joy. And I think we often lose sight of the joyful opportunities within these festivals. But it's, you know, we do have to be really mindful. And I love that our machzor has within it a blessing to recite if for medical purposes you need to eat. And medical purposes can be really broad. It can be psychological as well as physical.
One of the things that we've included, thanks to Rabbi Deborah at FRS this year, is actually a space, a physical space, which is signposted to the community, in which it's okay. And, you know, this is the place to come to eat. You don't have to explain yourself to anybody else, but also you don't have to be hiding yourself away in the toilet. You know, when I was pregnant one Yom Kippur, I was literally in a toilet cubicle with a banana, because the idea of, like, the shame of showing my community I was eating. But actually, there doesn't need to be that shame. As you say, there are many ways of elevating Yom Kippur in a very bodily way. I remember having a proper argument when I was about 12 at secondary school with... So my dad at the time was head of the Reform Movement. Her dad was the chair of the United Synagogue. So you can imagine, we both thought absolutely we were right, 100%. And she spent Yom Kippur at home and in bed, because otherwise she wouldn't have been able to get through the fast. And I spent the entire day at shul, but because I hadn't become bat mitzvah yet, I always had like snacks with me in case I needed to kind of break the fast, and that wasn't an issue. And this argument of like, you're not doing Yom Kippur properly, no, you're not doing Yom Kippur properly, was one of those great debates of, is it all about the fast, or is it about that communal experience of the liturgy and going through the day together?
Yeah, I love that. And I think actually I'm finding this a really helpful conversation to think about the intentionality of Yom Kippur. I love what Debbie was saying about, you know, reminding us of that teaching that and the tradition, Sephardi tradition, of this being the joyful day of like renewal and possibility as well. Often, I think because of my difficulties with food and all of that stuff, I get very focused on the fasting. I don't fast. I haven't done for many years, partly also because like leading a whole day of services is physically exhausting and I get very faint anyway and don't do it. But I like this idea of actually thinking more about, what am I going to, and I'm talking about this at Kol Nidrei Sermon, like, what am I going to feel at the end of Yom Kippur? What do I want to be liberated from? What do I want to walk out feeling refreshed and cleansed from and renewed by? That I'm interested in. And I love the embodied practice. So for me, like, I wear a kittel, I wear, you know, non-leather, just white trainers. There's something about that uniform, a white tallit, that I feel in such a different space. And personally, I find it really moving that I'm wearing something I'll be buried in. Sometimes I can't focus on it for too long because I find it a bit, it's hard. But also it helps me really, that embodied practice, which, you know, we could say in progressive Judaism, we've sometimes lost a bit of touch with, but there's, you know, really a sense of stepping in physically to something with the prostrating, if people do that on Musaf in the temple service, which makes, you know, is really huge. This year, I can't fast for medical reasons, and I'm going to be drinking during the service. And I'm actually really nervous about it in the same way you were saying, Miriam, of like, you know, putting my needs before the community. But I'm hoping what to do is to do a moment using our machzor and the ritual to say, anyone who can't fast for any reason, this is a moment to mark that and to find our own space of what this needs to be. And hopefully modelling and turning the conversation as we're doing together from, it's about the fasting too, it's about Yom Kippur. Fasting is one tool to help you get into the essence of what that is. And there are other ways, as Debbie was saying, that you can step into that and to really have that sense of restriction and affliction, because that's what it's about, isn't it? To afflict ourselves. Well, that's what the Torah understands it to be.
And I love that idea of the embodiment of it all. There's sort of, just like on Purim, we have fancy dress. There is a dress code. There is a fancy dress for Yom Kippur. We, you know, we might pick to wear certain things and not wear other things. But then how people relate to that is so fascinating. I think we might have a whole episode another time on the way people respond to our bodies and the things that women wear and all that stuff. But I remember as a student rabbi in one congregation on Kol Nidrei, I brought a couple of pairs of non-leather shoes with me. One was smarter, but not so comfortable. So Kol Nidrei, I was wearing just a pair of white plimp soles that were canvas. And there was a woman in the front of the congregation who spent almost the entire service just glaring at my feet. And they were clearly not smart enough for her perception of what Yom Kippur needed to be, whereas I was focusing on the humility and all the other stuff. So for Yom Kippur morning, I did wear the smarter shoes and was uncomfortable. And you were saying earlier, Robin, that people, you know, comment on weight after lockdown and things like that. You know, I've been asked not so long ago at a funeral if I was pregnant, and you know, all these, it's like, no, I'm just fat, right? And it's like that sense of being commentable on, right, what are the things that we're judging even on Yom Kippur is so interesting. And in case people don't know about the whole leather piece, not wearing leather is a sense of humility. So one of the restrictions that we're told to observe by the Talmud is to not wear leather shoes, because if we think about it, thousands of years ago, the only shoes really were leather. And if you're not wearing leather shoes, you're either barefoot or wrapping your feet in cloth or something. So it was really a sign of humility and mourning to some extent. Today, of course, there's Crocs and plimp soles and vegan shoes are plenty.
Oh, please tell me nobody's leading in Crocs.
But
I have to
wear plimp soles, apparently, or Crocs.
I have to say, because part of it is also accepting our own imperfections, right? And so on Kol Nidre, I'm talking about kind of our brokenness. And for me, there's a real moment of one of the things that I have to use Yom Kippur to do is to accept that there are certain things about me that I can't change. Maybe I don't want to change, but I have to accept who I am as myself with those brokenness. And I think one of those pieces is around vanity and around caring what other people think. Like, would I like to stand on the bima, like comfortable for 25 hours? You know, it's a really long day. Would I like to be more comfortable? Yes. Do I like the idea of wearing white and shrouds and kittles? Yes. Will I allow myself to do that? No. Even though the rest of my clergy team is in white, I can't. I just can't do it. I'm too vain. I can't
What's
stand.
The vanity about not wearing a nice wear?
Oh my gosh, because I can't look like I'm in my nightie, right? Basically, there's too many people that come once a year to only see me looking like I'm in an old-fashioned nightie. I just can't do it.
I've got a lovely white dress. It doesn't look like a nightie at all. It's got
I've been threatening for many years to come in my wedding dress because that's the only time I've looked nice in white. Apparently, it's not suitable. But, you know, there's that piece of me that just goes, I don't repent for being vain, because I'm standing here in a way that says I am vain. I'm too vain to follow these practices. And yet, like, that's the only way I can stand in front of my community and feel comfortable whilst standing before God. And so, you know, for me, there's all sorts of those choices. I find fasting much easier when I'm leading a service because I'm not obsessed with, there's not so much time to think about what am I going to eat, you know, as soon as the fast has gone out. I think as a child, I spent most of Yom Kippur sitting next to my best friend discussing what we might eat to break the fast. So, you know, it's not about that anymore. The fast is just part of the day and actually increases the feeling of frailty and engagement. But I can't go there with the white dress.
It's so funny. I'm the opposite to you, Miriam. I have the same principle of vanity, but I actually find wearing a kittle better because I don't have to worry about what I'm wearing. Like, I wear it because I find it a spiritual aid, but also it's because it's easy. But I love that idea of, like, and that is the balance of Yom Kippur, actually, isn't it? There is something about, we're not meant to chastise, we're not whipping ourselves being who we are. There is a sense of acceptance, deep acceptance and love for who we are, which I think is the first step towards everything. And, you know, there are things that I want to change for the better, but I think that's beautiful of loving ourselves warts and all, some of it just accepting, this is how I feel comfortable, this is what's right for me, I'm not harming anyone else by doing it, and I can accept it and name it. I think that's really powerful. But I think, you know, the challenge with it is the discernment of what is the stuff actually I do need to work on and what is the stuff I'm holding on to. That's the hard bit, isn't it? And that's potentially why we have 25 hours of, well, and these 10 days to be able to have the time to discern actually what is the thing that I need to be working on or can work on that isn't giving my essence away, but is, you know, helping me to walk out after Na'ila and hearing that shofar blast refreshed and ready for a new year ahead. We're all thinking about Na'ila.
We're all looking forward to Na'ila. I do get, it's an interesting, the Yizkot and Ila moment is for me one of those kind of rabbinic, so I think the longer that you're in a community as well, and the better known that you know the people on the Kaddish list for Yizkot, kind of the harder, the more powerful that service becomes, because it used to be about kind of my own sadness, and now it's very much a kind of a deep sense of, you know, this is what we as a community have lost. And so I find Yizkor year on year gets harder and harder. And I think that transition means that I then go into Na'ila a little bit kind of with a sort of excited mania almost of kind of, we've done this, we've achieved this. And I kind of flip into, so Na'ila is the time where I then become all four parts of the choir, where I need to join in loudly and with joy and do, you know, the very deep baritone, the very high alto, all the bits. There's something about, my goodness, we've come on this journey together. We're the ones that are going into the next year together. And that holding that Yizkor Na'ila kind of tension personally is interesting within a community setting.
I think one of the really nice things that has shifted for us through lockdown. Last year, we began having a Yizcor service that was a sort of parallel to the main Yizcor service, where people could come and share memories and not just listen to a list, but have space to actually talk about the person they're remembering. And we did it last year because we couldn't all be together, because we had the Zoom option, because we had lost a rabbi. And, you know, there was so much grief that we were holding. We wanted a different way to do Yizcor. And we're doing it again this year, both online and in person, because actually it offers us something additional to what's already there. For some people, coming to the regular Yizcor is absolutely right. And, you know, sitting and hearing all that incredible music, and it's deeply connecting. But actually having that chance to really be present with who you're remembering rather than listening to all the names of others is also part of that grieving that we lost over lockdown, right? We weren't allowed to grieve together in the way that we're used to. So we're finding new ways to do that.
It's such a lovely, such a lovely thing to offer the community. I don't know if you direct people to hesped.org, which is an amazing website. We started creating, one of our members started creating a booklet where people could offer a eulogy of the person that they had lost in the last year, so that people during Yom Kippur can be flicking through and reading the stories of the people of, in the community that we've lost that year. But there's something of a treasure trove of holding on to stories rather than names. Last year, we introduced photographs during the Yizkor, the list of names before Kaddish. And people have said, you know, that was fine on Zoom, but we can't let it go. We need to now always have the picture behind the name. And there's something so much more powerful about the story behind the picture behind the name. And treasure troves like that website that hold on to those stories for generations to come. So important.
What? So can you say more about hesped.org? I do know it, but it's brilliant.
So it is amazing, founded by Miriam Grabina, and you can go on and log the details of somebody that you have lost and upload your eulogy to the website. There's something about the fact that we have gravestones which give such bare facts about the person. And yet this is almost like the cemetery online that tells their stories and holds onto the eulogy as a beautiful mode of writing, that actually it tells stories of people's lives in a way that we don't tell at other times. And so it's kind of a treasury of that. Hesped.org. It's H-E-S-P-E-D, H-E-S-P-E-D.org. People wanted to look it up. I think even just their homepage that says whether someone led an ordinary life or an extraordinary one, we think their story's worth preserving. And isn't that the kind of nature of kind of where we've come from, right? We preserve our stories and we read so much into them. They don't need to be extraordinary for that.
I'm really glad you reminded me of that website, partly because I've found last year we were in a particular place with Yizkor, the memorial service, because there were so many people, it's funerals, and if the families, it was so important to come together. And it was, I remember it being very powerful. And actually the families stayed on Zoom after and we all talked and people shared memories kind of spontaneously. This year, going back into the community, I've really noticed, because Jackson's Row, everyone has their own seat. You know, I'm sure lots of synagogues do, but particularly Jackson's Row. And I really felt viscerally the loss of people over the last 2 years who aren't coming into synagogue, that they're physically not there, in a way that, you know, during, you know, when you're on Zoom, but when you're in the room and they're not there. So I think the memorial service is again going to be a really heavy moment. And Miriam, absolutely, that transition into the last service of Ne'ilah is always, and I think will continue to be, just the most powerful moment. And that last blast of the shofar, which I'm doing for the first time and a bit nervous about, because it's like the end and like I'm not a great shofar blast blower, but I feel fine about it, because Rabbi Lionel Blue always said, Zichrono Livracha, may his memory be for a blessing, that he couldn't blow the shofar. So I think, well, it's fine, I'm a disciple of Rabbi Lionel Blue. I'm just not one of my skill sets. But yeah, I'm really excited now we're talking about that final moment of Ne'ilah, the shofar blast, and just the energy and excitement of that moment, and the physical kind of tiredness all mixed in as well. Is there anything particular you break the fast with? I say my family don't necessarily have a tradition of like what the food is or kind of how we do it. It's a bit kind of ad hoc each year. We're just together. But my amazing mother-in-law, Roz, is a fantastic cook, and she cooks these little buns that are just gorgeous. And in past years, she's even been known to send them down by post from Glasgow because she's gorgeous like that. So that's become my taste now of breaking the fast. And that's a plea also, if you're listening, Roz, please do send them down.
Get them in the post now.
Already, first class, please. And do you have a particular tradition?
We tend to go fairly light breaking the fast because actually there's not, ironically, not a huge appetite. So we'll start with a cup of tea and a piece of honey cake. And funnily enough, I was posting honey cake this week to OJ Borg at Radio 2 because we were talking about it. And he did a live bake-off judgment of my honey cake. Apparently it was fine. It was good. And then we'll have a bowl of chicken soup usually, or vegetable soup, whatever we've got that we've made, and some challah. And that's it. It's breakfast the next morning when I'm usually ravenous.
Yeah.
For about 3 days, I make up for the like, well, I didn't eat on Yom Kippur. So and we don't do the breaking of the fast as any kind of social thing. For me, even more important than like eating at that point is I change into my pajamas before we eat. And, you know, it's that thing of just like comforting soup and bread and bits. I don't want to be faced with a big plate of food. But I think Johnny will be horrified if I don't mention the fact that actually I grew up in a house where there was a bubbling pot of chili con carne waiting for us to come back to. I have no idea where that tradition came from, other than the fact that it was something that my mum could clearly like make ahead of time, and it just needed a quick reheat when we all kind of arrived back from shul very hungry. But I realised that a spicy bowl of chili con carne maybe was unusual to others who were breaking it on cups of tea and challah and honey cake. So anyway, we'll just put that out there as a slightly strange Bayfield tradition.
I love that though, Miriam, because I think it's so important that we share personal traditions as well as like what should you do that is Jewish, right? Like our Friday night was always a Chinese takeaway because it was like a special thing. We did it on the way back from shul, and I think it's really important to share that there isn't like one way of being or doing Jewish, that it's your own, you know, that elevated and added to your sense of an occasion because it happened each year. I just think it's great. I love those kind of stories.
Growing up, we quite often broke fast on Chinese because Radlett Reform sits next to the extractor fan from a Chinese restaurant.
Oh my gosh.
And we would sit through Naila just smelling all the trays. It was amazing.
Wow.
Yes, there's definitely also, what does it highlight that often the like the Jewish way doesn't really fit into Judaism, because it involves, you know, usually the mother at home cooking so that when people get home from shul, there's food there. But when you come from a family where, you know, the women and the men are all at shul, actually the making sure that the roast chicken and the is all just perfectly timed when you've been at synagogue since, 9:30 that morning is more problematic. So I think that's also part of it, making new Jewish practices that fit into the new Jewish reality.
Absolutely.
So I understand we're being given a little bit of a break for a few weeks from our podcast. And so we won't be back until the 15th of October, but I'm going to miss you both because I love our chats. But the other episodes are available. If you've missed any, you can go back to reformjudaism.org.uk and have a listen. And if you are listening and have family and friends that are not, and you think that they might like to be part of the conversation, then do point them in our direction.
As always, you can get hold of us on media@rjuk.org. And also you can keep your eye on our social media channels for updates and news and to be the first to know when Rabbiting On is out. On Twitter, we are at Reform Movement. And on Facebook, it's the Movement for Reform Judaism. Or even on Instagram, you can find us at Reform Judaism UK.
We love knowing how many of you are listening from the UK and beyond. And we always share feedback and comments we get in person or by all of those social media channels. So do keep in touch. And wherever you're listening from, and until next time, we wish you very well, whether you are fasting or not. and hope that you have a refreshing, meaningful and liberatory Yom Kippur, where you have a sense of affliction or restriction that you need to be able to break through to where you are, but also holding it with some compassion in this time as well. So from all of us here at the Movement for Reformed Judaism, Gemar Chatima Tova and Shana Tova.
Shana Tova.
Gemar Chatima Tova.